morning. Can't see anyone in the back. I'm Andy Revkin. I write about climate, sustainability, whatever that is, population, biodiversity, for the New York Times online.
It's kind of echoey and far away.
The daughter's blog and in print, and doing the whole multitask thing, trying to figure out the future of journalism, even as we commit journalism, which is always an interesting challenge. This morning, we're trying to have a brisk conversation about the question I posed on the blog recently. Well, actually, I asserted, which is a rare thing for a reporter to do, that climate change is not the story of our time, that there's some other things happening on planet Earth, and you could look at climate, global warming, greenhouse forest
warming as kind of a symptom
underlying phenomena that are much broader, have much broader impacts on the planet than simply what's going on in the atmosphere and the chemistry
of the atmosphere and the oceans.
So I'm very privileged to be able to talk about this a little bit with Jane Lubchenco,
the NOAA administrator. I'm not going to go into her bio. You all know her background and how deeply involved she's been in the issues for a long time.
And the same really goes for Jonathan Lash at
World Resources Institute, who same pedigree, same length of time dealing with these issues.
So we'll start right in, and I'd like each of them to begin with sort of a short kind of response to that question. Is maybe climate change is not the story of our time, the audience, the storytellers. So if it isn't, if you agree that it is, maybe explain why. If you disagree, explain why. So Jane, if you could start.
Great.
Morning, everybody. I think climate change is an incredibly important story, but it is only one of many changes that are underway, all of which are interacting with one another. Climate change adds to and exacerbates many of the other environmental changes that are completely modifying the world as we know it. Andy has mentioned loss of biological diversity. That's certainly one of them. But overfishing, land use change, increased transport of invasive species, major modifications to some of the fundamental biogeochemical cycles of the planet, and I'm thinking in particular of nitrogen. We have doubled the amount of nitrogen that is available to be used by plants over the last century. And that is completely changing one of the fundamental cycles that affect which species are abundant on land, in the oceans, in rivers and streams. And so that's yet another major fundamental change. In addition to those, just how we are using the land. Land use, land cover change is being altered radically. So each one of those has major consequences to the functioning of the ecological systems that are providing all of our life support systems. And as we change the climate, as we change nitrogen cycles, as we lose biological diversity, as we acidify the oceans, we are changing the functioning of ecological systems that are providing the services that we need, whether those services are provision of pollination, the filtering and purification of water for drinking, partial climate regulation, the provision of places to enjoy and recreate, et cetera. All of those ecosystem services are being affected as we modify the functioning of these ecological systems. Now, that's all pretty nebulous. It's pretty, you know, up in the ether when it comes time to telling stories. So I think it is a major challenge not only to cover climate, but to cover these multiple interacting, intersecting changes that are underway. So it's a major, major challenge to everyone. And I think the real opportunity is to bring these things home by way of local stories, which is what you all do, where there are repeated themes. It's variations on a theme. And there have to be some overarching meta messages that link these different chapters of a book together, if you will. Now, how you do that, I can appreciate, is a very significant challenge, but I think that it's useful to simply understand the larger landscape that is out there.
Just one quick follow-up. Do you, in your experience in the Northwest or anyone else, anywhere else, did you have your own sense of a perfect example of a story that gets at the broader theme, but that has your own?
What a setup.
I mean, I have... I could help.
Do you have one in mind, Andy?
Well, some of the changing ocean conditions there seem to kind of get at this.
So I don't know how many of you know that... One of the issues that has arisen recently with respect to oceans is the increased appearance of dead zones. Most of the dead zones, of which there are now more than 400 around the world, are a result of runoff of nutrients, particularly nitrogen, but there's also a phosphorus component to the story, runoff of nutrients from the land. And the classic example of that here in the U.S. Is the Gulf of Mexico, but also Chesapeake Bay is a prime example, where nutrient pollution, as it is appropriately called, is stimulating the growth of the microscopic plants, the phytoplankton. They bloom explosively, grow explosively, begin to decay. Bacteria bacteria are decomposing that mass of phytoplankton, those microscopic plants, and the bacteria use up the oxygen in the water. And so you get development of zones of hypoxia, low oxygen, or even anoxia, no oxygen, as a result. In the Pacific Northwest, off the coast of Oregon and Washington, we've seen a very bizarre phenomenon, which is the appearance of a new dead zone in each of the last 8 years, starting in 2002, unknown before that. A new dead zone, low oxygen, no oxygen, that is triggered not by runoff of nutrients from land, but by changes in coastal winds that we believe are likely, most likely related to atmospheric changes associated with climate change. These are very rich, highly productive areas, and like the other major coastal upwelling ecosystems, which are off Chile, Peru, Namibia, South Africa, and the Canary Islands. Those coastal upwelling ecosystems have, they represent about 1% of the surface area of the oceans, and they have historically provided about 20% of the fisheries. And all of them are driven by coastal winds blowing along the coast, creating this phenomenon of upwelling. And as those coastal winds change, we are seeing the novel appearance of these dead zones or the intensification of dead zones that have been present in some of those areas. So we're seeing in very specific places some surprises as a result of climate change. Those surprises are, or this phenomenon is not something that anybody predicted or anticipated, but is very real nonetheless, and it sort of gives us, I think, should give us pause that there are lots of other surprises that are down the road. So this particular story is an example of how some of these things are interacting. The same phenomenon that is triggering these dead zones is also related to the delivery of low pH water, acidified water, to the surface areas of the ocean. So many of you know that the oceans have absorbed much of the carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. That's making oceans more acidic. That is likely to be problematic for many species in the ocean, but the places where ocean acidification is the most intense are these upwelling areas. So these areas that have historically been so incredibly productive and rich biologically and important to fisheries are on a routine basis now going belly up in the summertime with these low oxygen areas, but also being challenged by serious acidification that's only likely to get worse for a while.
Okay. So, Jonathan. What's your thought on this assertion?
Jane used to be my boss. She was a member of my board, and I hesitate to do it, but to make it more fun this morning, I'm going to disagree with her. I do completely buy the notion that we have altered fundamental biogeochemical systems. So I only got as far in science as high school biology. But I remember the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, and the hydrologic cycle. And we've disrupted all three. We're vastly increasing the input of carbon that we're drawing out of the earth and putting into the atmosphere. We're vastly increasing the input of nutrients, and we're growing our use of water twice as fast as human population and simply exceeding the surface capacity of the earth to provide it. And I have a really simple philosophy about sustainability after years of struggling with definitions and notions of exactly what it was and the three-legged stool and all that. Whatever can't be sustained won't be. And those trends can't be sustained. We cannot continue to alter the chemistry of the atmosphere as fast as we are, or the nitrogen cycle as fast as we are, or the hydrologic cycle as we are without consequences. And the consequences will be significant enough that they will force us to change. However, I'm not a scientist. I'm a lawyer. I don't do science professionally. I do policy. I'm from a think tank that tries to put ideas into action. And so I see this question, Andy, in a different framing. Jane was talking about the astonishingly profound consequences of human activity. But I see climate change as the most significant issue of our times because I focus on efforts to change human activity. And from that point of view, the most important effort underway to change what human beings do and its consequences for the Earth has to do with climate change. And what we're trying to achieve both in domestic climate change discussions and in international discussions is fundamentally different than what we have done in any environmental policy debate before. There are a lot of you here who I have been talking to about these issues for decades. And in the 30 or so years that I've worked on environmental issues, I've been involved in dozens of legislative fights. And in all of those, the objective was a single endpoint in space and time, right? You have this stack. We don't like what's coming out of it. You put this piece of machinery on the stack, and you reduce what's coming out of it. And when you do that, you're done. And if you want to build another stack, you have to put another machine on, but you can go on building other stacks. There's no fundamental alteration in the pattern of our economy in doing that. But if you look at what's proposed in climate change legislation, and I'm sure we'll get deeper into how significant it is, but if you just look at either the Waxman-Markey bill that passed the House or the Boxer-Kerry bill that's proposed in the Senate, it's completely and utterly different. It's a roadmap. It's not an endpoint. It says in 2015, we're going to have reduced the amount of CO2 coming out of the whole economy by this much, and by 2020, we're going to reduce it further, and by 2030, we're going to reduce it further, and by 2040, further. And that roadmap approach, as opposed to the single endpoint, is very, very different, because we're not saying you can go on doing what you're doing, you just have to add one of these in the stack. We're saying we're going to alter the entire economy. And the purpose of the global negotiations is to discuss whether we're prepared as a globe to say we're going to alter the entire pattern of development. You had the Chinese head of state speaking for the first time at the United Nations, and he said China is prepared to take quantitative targets in terms of changing the way its economy works, the carbon intensity of its economy. It's an astonishing moment. And I think that's profoundly important because of what it does to the whole investment and decision-making process that essentially determines what our economy looks like. I have often told a story which just characterized this for me. I went with Jeff Immelt and Jim Rogers and Chad Holliday, three CEOs from the United States Climate Action Partnership, to visit with the editorial board of the Washington Post just as USCAP was about to issue its blueprint for legislative action last January. And skeptical, I think, would be an understatement of the reaction we were getting. And they kept asking, why in the midst of a downturn are you guys saying you want to be regulated? We just don't buy it. There's something else here. What's going on? Explain it to us. And finally, Fred Hyatt asked Chad Holliday, if the president signed this climate bill you recommend today, what would you do differently tomorrow? And Chad said, last week, I canceled work on a plant to manufacture a new thin-film solar technology that we've developed. We think it is an absolute winner. It is going to completely change our approach to the use of solar energy, but I don't know when the market's going to be there. I have to cut costs somewhere, so I'm cutting this. If he signs the bill today, I restart construction tomorrow because I know there's a market. He said, I'm spending $100 million a year on third and fourth generation biotechnology-based fuels, and we could accelerate the availability of those new technologies by doubling the research budget. There's no reason for me to spend that money if I don't know there's a market. If the president signs the bill, I know there's a market. I double the money tomorrow. So I think this roadmap idea is a huge change in the way we approach changing human behavior and solving problems. And for those reasons, I think it's a very, very big story, even though I actually buy everything that Jane said. And one of the best days I've ever spent was a day watching her grad students collect the data that she's using to tell you about the dead zone off the Northwest coast.
Thank you. To keep things kind of brisk, I'm going to start right in with audience questions because I see a lot of eager faces out there. Keep it a question, please, and keep it brief, please. And also make sure your cell phones and stuff are off. I heard a little, like, that weird cosmic interference with the mic a minute ago. I don't know if there's a cell phone on. Right there, and then here.
Good morning. I'm Kim Kastens from Columbia University.
I'll repeat the question. So.
And I wonder how you think that peak oil or other limitations of resources fit in with the global warming change in your idea.
Go ahead.
You're the resources guy, right?
I'm the resources guy. Oil prices are going to figure in, but if we set about the process of fundamentally altering how we use carbon and how much CO2 we emit, I don't think peak oil is going to be the driver. If we wait for peak oil to be the driver, we're not actually going to make any change in the way the economy emits CO2.
And actually, the ground rules here are journalists first, so are there any journalists with questions out there? Yeah.
You talked about this being a revolution in how we run our lives. How is this any different than other revolutions, such as the invention of the steam engine, the invention of the mass-produced automobile? I mean, those caused profound changes, you know, and yet they happen. Why is this different? In other words, there's going to be new technology out
right
there, and if it works, if it's better, it's going to take over regardless.
Did everyone? The question was: so, what makes this this energy revolution or innovation moment different than past ones? Internal combustion, et cetera, et cetera.
So, can I rephrase the question a little bit and see?
Sure.
Why do we need policy to drive this transition if technology and innovation have driven previous transitions? And I agree with you completely. Those were profound transitions, as was the one that started in the United Kingdom in about 1820, the use of coal to generate steam to create power so people could improve their lives. Fossil fuels have been enormously significant in improving the quality of life for billions of people. I think if we waited till the next century that we would see those revolutions taking place, among other things because renewable energy doesn't depend on a fuel, therefore you don't have rising fuel costs. Therefore, eventually, when you drive down the initial capital costs, you'll drive fossil fuel out, but we don't have time. The consequences of the emissions from the use of fossil fuel are too great, and the pricing of fossil fuels fails too badly to reflect those consequences. So we need some sort of policy intervention to assure that the transition takes place more quickly. And also we have an enormous inertia because of the scale of our capital investment in ways of using fossil fuels.
And state your name, too. Sorry. The question was, can we avoid a 2-degree C increase from pre-industrial temperature, which is the actual pledge that Europe made and people are sort of signing on to, which, by the way, that translates into a 1-degree rise in temperature in Fahrenheit from today's temperature. I don't know why people do these weird things, like set a goal that's from a pre-industrial baseline. So can we survive a 1-degree rise from today's temperature?
Can we survive or can we avoid?
Well,
can we avoid was the question.
Can we avoid, and what's the likelihood of 4 degrees?
It's increasingly unlikely that we're going to avoid it, but it depends on how quickly we act and how effectively we act.
So you made the question too easy by using the word can. I think we can. If the word is will, I think that's a much tougher question, and it doesn't appear that we're on a course to slow emissions fast enough so that we're likely to – we're about 0.7 degrees, I think, Andy, centigrade, so it's another 1.3 degrees centigrade, and it just doesn't look like we're on a path to reduce emissions that fast.
I think a number of them have been highlighted and are fairly well known. You know, the prospects of increasing release of carbon from the Arctic as it warms is certainly one of them. A lot of attention has been paid to. Well, I don't want to go there. I was going to talk about...
Oh, where?
Oops. I think that one of the... So, you know, that is an example of some of the uncertainties which would have dramatic consequences. You know, there are others that have to do... That would result in serious consequences, like if we had... much more rapid melting of ice sheets, ice caps. We have very serious consequences with respect to sea level rise. So there are a number of thresholds in the climate system that we don't really know where that edge is, and we don't understand enough about the dynamics to know exactly when those are going to be triggered.
Could I add three? Probably because I'm not a federal official and I don't have to be quite as careful. Certainly, we're seeing the reduction of the albedo effect, that is, less ice reflecting less heat and therefore faster ocean warming in the north and eventually in the south, certainly on the glaciers. So we've seen that. We saw an episode of Amazon drought which astonishingly quickly shifted the Amazon from being a carbon sink to a carbon source, just like a an on-off switch. I don't know if you would have predicted that, but that one blew my mind. The Amazon drought has ended, so that process was reversed. But the predictions are that there will be repeated large-scale droughts. If that happens, the Amazon is a major potential source, even if we avoid deforestation. And then we have the rising evidence of seabed methane seeps because of warming Arctic waters.
Because this was about some other forcings that are underway that are consequential, I want to kind of get at the Amazon very quickly. I've written recently about a bunch of studies that say if you stem fragmentation of the Amazon, you make it a much more robust system in the face of whatever climate change will bring, and that the modeling is actually very equivocal on which way it's going to go. So this gets at some of these questions about other things that are happening now in the face of the planet that are very consequential, even if you put climate at the top of the list, that maybe aren't getting adequately addressed. And I wondered if you could quickly get at that, and then we'll take some more questions.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Andy. I think that if we recognize that there are interactions between climate change and a lot of the other environmental changes that are underway that I mentioned earlier, it gives us a different way to think about how do we adapt to climate change? How can we make the systems that we depend on more resilient to some climate changes that are inevitable? And to the extent that, so if we recognize that, for example, in ocean ecosystems, climate change interacts with loss of biological diversity, with nutrient pollution, with transport of invasives, and each of those is putting additional stresses on the functioning of those systems. If we reduce some of those stresses over which we have a fair degree of control, flow of nutrients to oceans, transport of invasives, overfishing, we have more control, immediately control over those than we do of climate, for example. And if we would be more responsible about each of those and reduce those stresses, it's likely that those systems are going to be more resilient to the climate-related changes that are inevitable, regardless of how fast we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I think it is worthwhile to think about these interactions and to think about how do we increase the resilience of the natural systems on which we depend, be they managed natural systems like agricultural systems and aquacultural systems, or natural systems, unmanaged systems?
More questions. While we're waiting for the next journalist, there's one right here.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, I am writing a book on this. So my name is Brian Check. I'm also a public servant. I work in the National Office of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And there, you can't talk publicly yet about what I would ask whether it should be the overarching meta message that Jane mentioned for all these issues. What about economic growth? Increasing production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate. That obsession with economic growth is one of the reasons we don't have a chance at avoiding that probably 4°C increase by 2100. Biodiversity, due to the tremendous spread of the human niche, which expands via technological progress, the human economy grows at competitive exclusion on human species in the aggregate. So, shouldn't that be the overarching meta message for journalists to connect all these problems, the problem of economic growth, or should we say uneconomic growth at this point in history?
So the question is, are we missing the big story, which is that growth is not sustainable on a finite planet?
So I think the answer depends very much on how you define growth. In a world in which there are 2 billion people who don't have enough, I don't think it is politically or morally feasible to say, we got to stop economic growth. So you have to grow some things. You have to grow human well-being. You have to grow people's... I got it. Let me answer your question. Of course, we can solve those problems in different ways. But I think we can grow people's access to information. I think we can grow people's access to services and technology. I think we can grow economic activity based on knowledge without consequences for use of resources. But I do think we have to recognize that the systems that support human well-being have a finite capacity to put out the products on which we rely. So if the question is, can we go on forever expanding our use of natural resources and our release of wastes into the environment? No, we can't. And we have to address that, and we have to address that in a way that not only responds to wealthy societies like North America or Europe, but also lays out a path by which India and China can improve the lives of people without increasing throughput.
More questions? Yeah, over here.
I'm Katie Elwood. I'm a freelance writer, and I would like to ask if you could comment about any interaction between climate change and the proliferation of toxic chemicals in the environment, which has been in the news due to the EPA director's recent efforts. And also, do you think that toxic chemical pollution ever would have the potential to overtake climate change as the so-called issue of our time?
Do you want to repeat that, Andy? You can buy me some time here, buddy.
That, you were talking about conventional pollution as opposed to where are you? I missed.
Toxic chemical pollution.
Could that actually come to the top of the list, essentially?
The
sort of conventional pollution and this thing called CO2 and the other greenhouse gases.
I think that we know less about the interactions between chemical pollutants and climate change. I can't give you any immediate examples of how those are interacting, comparable to some of the things I mentioned earlier. There's no doubt but that toxins, both sort of historically focused ones or the ones that we used to focus on, but more recently appreciated persistent organic pollutants, for example, are very serious, threatening the well-being of many species. But exactly how that's interacting with climate is a little more nebulous.
Certainly, one of the relevant issues is soot, particulate pollution, which has all kinds of bad stuff in it, and it is a forcing. It is a heating element in the atmosphere, and we've been doing a series in the Times all year called "By Degrees," which is examining what can you do in the short run while you deal with this big giant gorilla of CO2, the cumulative greenhouse gas, the big one, to cut the heating of the atmosphere now. And soot is definitely getting those 2 billion people who are cooking on firewood and dung. Some alternative that's less polluting is doing lots of things right now, including lessening warming. Other questions? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nancy Basil-Chuck. I'm a freelance journalist, and I get the pleasure of disagreeing with my former boss, Jonathan Lesch. Jonathan said earlier that the problem with climate change legislation is that it's a roadmap, not an endpoint, unlike anything we've done. And as I'm sitting here listening to this discussion, I'm thinking, why is this different than any other tax legislation that we've enacted, where we set goals and say we're going to have this percent tax at this time and this percent tax at this time? In fact, if you cut to the chase, controlling climate change is really a matter of making those decisions with the tax. It's a difference of degree, not in terms of legislation, and are we over the complexity of the issue nonetheless? If you sort of look at it in its fundament, are we sort of blowing this out of proportion? Should we not just say, look, this is the way to solve it, a climate tax, a carbon tax, or whatever it is that we use in terms of tax policy? So,
did everyone hear that? I think so.
Good. This one takes two mics. So the question was first, is the carbon roadmap really different from other policies we've pursued that we've had tax policies? I can't think of a lot of examples where we've had tax policies where something was taxed at one level, then at two times that level, then at three times that level, and at four, although we have increased taxes sometimes, but we've never laid out a roadmap saying we're going to increase taxes. On cigarettes, for instance, we've increased taxes again and again, but we didn't 50 years ago say it's going to be a penny a pack today, but it's going to be, $4 a pack or something like that in 50 years. But still, Nancy asked an important question, which is couldn't we just do a carbon tax, a phased-in, ramped-up carbon tax? And of course, the answer is yes, and most economists would say, and it's much more efficient, and it's much more elegant, and it doesn't give Congress the chance to give away free allocations of carbon credits. It's much less corrupt. And I think that's all legitimate. In fact, in responding to the earlier question about why we couldn't just wait for innovation, I said one of the problems is that we have not internalized the costs of emitting CO2 into the air. All of that said, I absolutely do not believe that the United States Congress would ever phase in a carbon tax and continue to build it up over time. I don't think that they are likely to be willing to address this problem through taxation. And I think that one of the advantages of a cap and trade, a market-based system, is that you can say our objective is environmental. Therefore, we're going to set the environmental limit and let the price rise rather than set the price and just get whatever environmental benefit we can get. From my point of view, this is about changing technology and protecting the environment, not about the price of carbon.
I'm going to ask a quick follow-up. We've been writing a series, not a discrete series, but a chain of coverage for years now, examining the question of whether a rising cost on carbon dioxide emissions that is politically feasible could be powerful enough to actually transform, to spur innovation. And when you ask a lot of economists and historians of technology and energy this question, they all say no, and not all, but it's hard to find in that community anyone with any confidence that the kind of energy technology transformation that would be required to decarbonize a world as it adds to China's worth of people in the next 40 years is far beyond what a politically realistic carbon cap or tax could accomplish, that you need direct investment in basic research, sustained aggressive investment in basic research with a directed pipeline of money to the bottom of the innovation pipeline rather than this soft kind of forcing from the top. And I wondered, I don't know, Jane, you might be constrained in some way or other from dealing with that, but I think, Jonathan, you could explore that a little bit. Do you think that that's – is there any merit to that argument?
Go ahead.
We would have to be nuts not to make direct investment in research to develop the new technologies. If we don't, others are going to. Those are the markets of the future. I just pose you a question. Think of 40 years from now, 2050, when our grandchildren are – running the world. Do you really imagine that they are going to be living in a world whose economy is based on the burning of fossil fuels and the release of vast amounts of carbon dioxide into the air? That would mean 4 degrees is not only are we at 4 degrees, we're going by 4 degrees, right? So I ask this question to groups that I speak to all the time, and I don't find many people who are willing to argue to me that it's going to look the same in 2050. If that's the case, the debate we're having now is just about how we make the transition. We're only really talking about how we're going to manage the transition to the low-carbon economy and who's going to make the products that get us there, sell the services that get us there. And of course, we need huge research investments to do that. But as of 2 years ago, GE was putting more money into research on efficient and green technologies than the federal government was. The real question is how much private money we can leverage into that. How much venture capital money, how much innovation can be driven with the lever of federal research investments, but not thinking that that's the whole thing. And I think that requires more policy than just research and development investments.
Anyone in the back? I haven't seen any hands way in the back. Okay, yeah, good.
Ask.
Hard to hear you.
So you said that we're talking about a fundamental change in the way we do things. And some of us yesterday were on a field trip where the owners of a power plant were very proudly installing a huge gadget on top of their stack to collect carbon dioxide. And now this is going to be the answer. So is that part of the answer or not?
We get more than half of our electricity from coal. Much of the world depends on coal. There are vast supplies of coal, so there will be huge incentives to find ways to capture CO2 and do something with it. Inject it underground, make cement, I think is what Vinod Khosla wants to do, grow algae and turn the algae into fuel. But that's one of those technologies that leads the economists that Andy talks to say it would take a really big carbon tax to get us there.
Just very quickly, next Saturday I'm interviewing a guy named Vaclav Shmil on stage in Toronto, who's one of the smartest people I've ever met dealing with energy and history and technology and environmental issues as well. He seems to know everything. Several years ago, he gave a speech at an OECD meeting on energy and climate in Paris that no one has yet undercut. And on carbon capture and storage, this idea of clean coal, he said he painted a little picture with numbers, and numbers are helpful. He said that to capture 10% of today's emissions of CO2, 10% of today's emissions, not what they'll be when China and India get into high gear. So 1/10 of today's emissions of CO2, to capture that, compress it, put it in the ground somewhere, you'd need as much infrastructure built on this planet as we now use worldwide to extract oil from the ground. So the same amount of pipes, compressors, stuff that we now use to extract a $60 to $100 a barrel commodity to deal with a waste gas. So even if it works, scale is a huge challenge. It also is for nuclear and many other issues. So we have to keep that in mind right away. Always think scale when you're asking questions about carbon capture and that kind of thing. Next question back there.
Hi, I'm Dave Tenenbaum from Y-Files. I'm thinking of the transport of the wind industry, particularly the solar industry, from Europe and the U.S. and Japan to China. And the question is, facetiously phrased, is this the final triumph of communism? But more seriously phrased, how come the capitalists can't figure this out? How come they can't see the pot of gold in front of their noses?
I'm not sure I understand the core of the question.
Why is capitalism failing to respond to the financial allure of alternative energy?
So if it's a no-brainer, why isn't it happening? Yeah. Good question.
You're as qualified as I am. There are a lot of capitalists who would like to respond. I mean, I think this is a policy issue. And exacerbated by the fact that we fell into an economic hole that we haven't gotten ourselves out of. So the money that was the huge amounts of money that were moving into green technology stopped for a while. If we want to develop our capacity to manufacture green goods and services to sell to the world, we need to create a domestic market. We can do that through incentives and through policies, and we don't have enough in place yet.
Hi, David Biello, Scientific American. My question is, as a scientist turned government policymaker, what you see the role of scientists in addressing these issues, what their new role might be, and also,
What's the role of scientists in addressing these issues? Asked of a scientist who has become a policy, entered that dangerous arena.
So one of the reasons that I signed up was my belief that the president who articulated that good government depends on good science would be true to his word in both respecting the integrity of science, but also making policy decisions that were informed by science. And we're seeing that, I think, play out in very significant ways in this administration. There is science at the table in most of the policy decisions that are being considered. I don't think anyone would be sufficiently naive to think that science is the only driver of decisions, but it is certainly at the table in this administration. And I think that's true whether it's climate or ocean policies or pretty much anything else. I think the fact that the president is has signaled that he really wants to address climate change, that he is working actively to make that happen, is an indication that he is really convinced by the scientific information on this front. You know, in this country, it's politically challenging, and the fact that he continues to push hard on this is because he believes the science. You know, there's scientists that are actively engaged in all of these topics, which is, I think, all to the good.
Do Americans believe in science anymore?
It's not a belief.
That's an excellent question.
You live in Norway.
I'm speaking for the group.
Is there anyone out there I'm missing? There's a couple of people who have already asked questions, want to ask another one. But anyone?
Second back.
Wave. Oh, yes, yes. I assume everyone heard that. Is there a way to communicate why the loss of biodiversity matters to the average person? Yeah, to the average person. Yeah.
I think this is another of the, you know, of Andy's slow drip, drip, drip issues that's hard for people to really wrap their heads around, especially for the non-charismatic species that are not particularly appealing to at least some. The way I think about biodiversity is more from a functional standpoint, understanding that the full component of biodiversity in an ecosystem makes that system robust, resilient, able to accommodate change, if you will, and that understanding that we as people depend on the ecosystem services that are provided by those ecological systems is I think, what the relationship is to the things that people care about if they don't care about those individual species. And if you think about oceans, for example, one of the things that I've spent time doing in the last 5 or 6 years is to try to understand how people in this country think about oceans. You know, they're sort of out there. You know, we don't live right in oceans, so what's happening in oceans is a little more, little less real for a lot of people. and they are so immense and so seemingly bountiful and infinitely resilient that we think we can treat them as not have to take care of them, that we can have them be, we can take as much out as we want and dump as much in, and it's not going to make a difference. And that obviously is not the case. You know, story after story has emerged saying how significant the disruption and depletion is. But if you ask people what they want from oceans, we tend to hear sort of many a core number of things that Americans say. They want safe, healthy seafood. They want clean beaches. They want abundant wildlife, vibrant coastal communities. They want stable fisheries, clean energy, good jobs. Most, though not all of those, most of those depend on having healthy, productive, resilient ocean ecosystems. And so the challenge is that the connection between the component of biodiversity and the delivery of those services is a little bit nebulous in many people's minds. But there are a number of concrete examples where loss of biological diversity has made the system much more susceptible to undergoing radical change. If you look at coral reefs, for example, there's a classic example of coral reefs in Jamaica where the herbivores in the system, which include turtles, urchins, fishes, for example, have for a long time been those herbivores are important in keeping the growth of the algae in check so that the corals can thrive. And when you go and dive or snorkel on a coral reef, you don't see a lot of seaweeds. You see very abundant, spectacular coral reefs if you're in a place that has not been seriously disrupted. But if you remove one group of herbivores, turtles, which were removed historically, other herbivores in the system compensated for the loss of those turtles and were able to keep the seaweeds, the algae, in check. When fishes, the herbivorous fishes, were overfished, there was a little bit of compensation that the other herbivores in the system, in this case sea urchins, were able to more or less keep algae in check. But as when a disease hit, swept through the Caribbean and eliminated many of the sea urchins, then all of a sudden there was a dramatic change in the system. It had lost its resilience, its ability to accommodate these changes. And so this redundancy, this ability to compensate, sort of have second, third options for providing the same function, you lose species and you lose either a function or the ability to have some compensation. And so over time, what we're seeing in more and more ecological systems as we lose biological diversity is that they become more susceptible to undergoing radical change. And in this case, weedy seaweeds overgrowing these systems, completely eliminating coral reefs and turning spectacular diverse reef systems into essentially weedy algal wastelands.
I want to interject a quick logistics note. We're down to the last 15 minutes before the session in the next room. So one thing I've been told to ask you is make sure you have your security badge on, whatever your, so there's no trouble getting into the next room, because there will be a lot of checking of that stuff. And so the next little round of questions here. Yeah. That was my next question.
Are we responsible as journalists for being fearful of that word because we get pushback on that? I just think this needs to be broached. So could you broach it, please?
The question was about the P word, population, or the O word, overpopulation. Is there a reason this doesn't come up more in the climate discourse particularly, and just this general question of how many people, how much stuff? We tend to see not to focus on the people part.
From a scientific standpoint, I think it's pretty obvious that number of people is important, but so too is their per capita impact, their per capita use of resources, their per capita generation of wastes. And I believe that we need to think about all parts of that equation. So I think that that does need to be on the table. I think it has become politicized both within the U.S. but also internationally, and that it is appropriate for us to be taking a more holistic look and understanding that it has to. All of those are important.
Jonathan, any thoughts?
So should I recently posed the question on the blog: should there be carbon credits for one-child families? You know, why don't they get into this game if we're going to have a cap and trade system, especially in America, where you're talking about saving 20 tons per year by not having a kid?
Ah, well, they've talked about that in other places. Mm-hmm. Other questions, again.
Andy, could I jump in here? And
yeah, there's one in the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, you know, as we talk about covering climate change, I wanted to make sure that everybody was aware of the climate change impacts in the United States report that the federal agencies collectively worked on and released just recently. It is a description of how climate change has already impacted different parts of the United States, region by region. And so, you know, instead of just talking about continental scale or global scale changes, bringing it down to regions and to individual sectors in the United States, I think is very useful information in making the changes more relevant to the things that people care about. You know, and the message of this report is that it's not something that is off, you know, way down the road in the future. It's not something that is affecting just remote parts of the planet. There are documented, scientifically accurate changes that have been measured in people's own backyards, in the parts of the world that they care about. And I think that that might be useful information as you're covering stories and looking for credible, useful numbers of exactly what do we know about how it has changed, where it has changed, and projections of or forecasts for some of the changes that are down the road, again, region by region.
I wanted to go back to the question about the role of scientists in government and Jane couldn't say this, but we have three of America's top scientists now in senior positions in government, not just Jane, John Holdren, and Steve Chu, and the impact on the quality of the discussion in federal agencies by having that kind of leadership and therefore essentially the legitimization or the re-legitimization of science in policymaking has been enormous. But I was thinking, Jane, as you were talking about this assessment of impacts in the U.S., it doesn't solve the second part of the problem. It is still the case that people are much more interested in Letterman's love life than in seabed methane, and I don't think that's going to change. We have the problem that the things that we've been talking about this morning are essentially long-term and systemic change, and people are interested in events. They are about things that will happen then to someone else, not me. When you gave your list of what people look for oceans, they're all answers to the question, what's in it for me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't find that abhorrent or surprising, but it's still real. There's also the problem of the visible and the concrete. Love Canal was really easy. And the possibility that the Great Ocean Conveyor will stop is really hard. But the consequences of Love Canal were confined to a very narrow point in time and a very few people. If the Great Ocean Conveyor stops, the consequences are almost incalculable. So having these terrific people in government gives you the basis, but you still have to find a way to translate that.
Mm-hmm. Was that question still live back there?
Sure, it kind of builds on that. One of our speakers the other night pointed out that there are virtually no peer-reviewed articles that say climate change is not human-caused. There are lots that say it is. Yet, the one side with little or any scientific support is almost held on the same level. And is that a failure of scientists to communicate? Is it the result of gullible reporters?
Andy, you've written on this.
Well, there's two book chapters I've written about this. So to cut to there was one by NASW in their field guide for science journalism that gets at there's a huge number of reasons why the public presentation of these issues is warped away from the scientific reality. Actually, maybe a way to reframe that question for both of you is, how concerned are you about the implosion of specialized journalism that's underway? And do you see a way to continue telling the story of science and how it relates to policy effectively in this cloud of whatever it is that's coming now?
I am extremely concerned about what's happening in the world of journalism today. And I think we're in a very unstable time. As we enter more and more the electronic world, I think it's harder and harder for people to know whom to trust. And how to evaluate information. And you know, when I started teaching many years ago at the university level, one of the things that we tried to help students understand was where to go to get information. We used to actually have tours of the library. What's on which floor? Where to go to find information. Nobody has that problem anymore. Everybody is inundated with information, and the challenge now is not where to get it, but how to evaluate it, how to know whom to trust, how to ask the right questions. And as we enter this world of blogs and tweets and Facebook and, you know, all the whole shebang, knowing whom to trust, it's going to be a while before that sorts out. Completely setting aside the challenges of the business models, which I know is what's driving a lot of the changes in the world of media. So it's very disturbing to me. And the importance of having really good, scientifically knowledgeable, scientifically credible, gifted journalists who can cover all of these stories is immensely important to having a functional democracy, to having people have access to the information that they need to make smart decisions. And I think that that world is changing radically, and it's not clear where we're headed.
Okay, quick follow-up. Can the president kind of make a difference with the bully pulpit stuff? They had a dog and pony show at the White House the other day with the Geodome and Science and Astronomy Day. But I didn't see, even in our paper, it only made it into the caucus blog. It didn't make it into print.
Letterman was more exciting.
Oh, there you go.
any right here.
Okay, I'm a non-journalist.
Yeah, I think you're okay.
Are we all right? My question is, I'm Bianca DeLillo with the Science Communication Network. My question is, I have friends who are really knowledgeable, or even just guys on the bus when I go to work in the morning, seem to understand the overall scientific picture about climate change. But I've been told by people that they don't feel like there's a solution until they turn it off. And so I'm just wondering if there's some overall sense of, you know, some message or something that we can do that it's very complicated to make it a little more simple for the public, not dumbing it down.
So
we'll repeat the question.
Yeah, the question is, when is it enough essentially for people to just hear that there are problems without offering them solutions, and that one of the impediments to progress may be the lack of obvious solutions that have been offered? That's not exactly the way you articulated it.
That they just turn it off because
And it's easy to turn it off if there aren't any immediate things. You know, I think one of the most important developments of the last few years has been the engagement of social scientists in paying attention to raising the attention of other scientists to the importance of what social scientists have learned about communication. And for problems as significant as climate change, what social scientists have told us is that you need to, for people to be motivated to take action on something like climate change that is so big, they need to be reassured that, in fact, it's real, that the science is relatively certain, that it's going to affect them personally or the things that they care about, that there are solutions and that there's something that they personally can do. And so I think it is important, and I think one of the mistakes that was made early on in this was to focus more on just the natural science story without understanding the importance of providing solutions and providing things that could be done. Now, obviously, that's a complex, I mean, but that's where we are now, and I think that has to be part of the message.
Two quick concrete responses. On the next panel you have, two of the people represent the best of the response to your question. So Vice President Gore has a book coming out in another month, and it is the answer to that question. He has decided that's the key. It's the book about solutions. Jim Rogers from Duke Energy was speaking, so he's one of the largest consumers of coal in the world, and as a member of the United States Climate Action Partnership, is completely focused on the idea, as is this whole partnership of 27 of the world's biggest corporations, on the idea there are all kinds of solutions out there. We can make an enormous amount of money by developing them and selling them. Please just give us the policy setting so we can get on about it. Remove the uncertainty. I'm deeply frustrated by this idea. Yeah, it's a problem, but I don't want to deal with it because there's no solution. There are two. We just haven't started.
Well, thank you both, Jane and Jonathan, for spending your time with us. Thank you all for coming.
Great.